Okay.
Just...
And their defining principle is gauge invariance. However, in practice, when we do calculations, gauge invariance is broken. It is broken by gauge fixing, and it gets broken by the regularization procedure in general. I think we are all familiar with the breaking of gauge invariance induced by gauge fixing, and we know how to deal with it. Instead, this second source of violation of gauge invariance might be less familiar. So let me just spend a couple of words on it. So in general, when we go beyond tree level, we need a way to regularize our theory. And the way we usually do it is that we choose a regularization that tries to preserve as many symmetries as possible of the theory we are regularizing. And here comes an important point, which is that for chiral gauge theories, for chiral gauge local theories, there is no consistent regularization that preserves gauge invariance, even if the theory is anomaly free. So when the theory satisfies this condition here, which you probably have seen many times, I will refer to it as the Georgi condition. In other words, okay, the regularization procedure creates gauge violating contributions beyond those removed by this condition. And the question is, how do we deal with these contributions? So how do we restore a gauge invariance? There are two main strategies. One possibility is to enforce the word identities by hand, so process by process. And a more systematic approach instead is to enforce gauge invariance directly at the level of the effective action, so the generator of all one particle irreducible graphs. This first approach is easier, but it has some disadvantages. First of all, one needs to find the correct word identities really case by case. And the second problem is that one might run into possible ambiguities when comparing different processes. Instead, in the second case, one handles all amplitudes at once. And this is what we want to do. And we want to do it for a very simple case, for a renormalizable in the strict sense, a renormalizable theory with an arbitrary gauge group and some chiral fermions. Actually, to be honest, we wanted to address this problem directly for the SMAP. But then we realized that even this simpler case of a renormalizable chiral gauge theory with fermions of both chiralities have never been fully addressed in the literature. So we decided to start from there. We hope that including scalars and higher dimensional operators won't give us unexpected conceptual difficulties, but okay, in general, that's the plan for the future. So for the moment, I will stick to a chiral theory with fermions. And this is a very, very simple setup. So we just have a compact gauge group, which could be the product of several simple gauge groups on some U1 factors. We have gauge fields, structure constants, and the matter content is just two massless chiral fermions that transform under some representations of the gauge group. So TL for the left-handed fermions and TR for the right-handed one. Now, what you see here is just the usual action. We have the Young-Mills term for the gauge bosons, and then the interaction of the gauge bosons with the fermions and their kinetic term. And we all know that this is invariant under infinitesimal gauge transformations of the fermion fields and of the gauge fields. At this point, essentially, I have all the ingredients to introduce. Why?
No idea.
You said something wrong.
I think I didn't, right? I just a Young-Mills like action. I think that was correct.
Well, it's recording still. Maybe someone accidentally pressed it twice.
Good.
Okay.
Let's continue.
Okay.
Why do you have the advantage? You can say whatever you want.
No, well, but it's you. I want to say correct things. Okay, so I need now to introduce two identities because I will need them all the time in the rest of the talk. And these are the word identities and the vast domino condition. I know you probably all know what a word identity is, but sometimes this wording is used for different identities. So I want to define what I mean by word identity. So first of all, what do? The word identities, they express the gauge invariance of some functional. And whenever we compute the gauge variation of a functional, we can write it in the form you see here, where this alpha is some infinitesimal gauge parameter that describes the transformation, and this L is some differential operator. So whenever this functional is gauge invariant, we can express this both in a, let's say, in an integral and in a differential way. And this is the identity I will refer to as the word identity for F. The vast domino conditions, instead, they are conditions that really just follow from the algebra of the gauge group, and they hold no matter the functional we are considering. So if this functional is gauge invariant, they are trivially satisfied because you get 0 equals 0. But if F is not gauge invariant, one gets a non-trivial constraint from these conditions. And I will use this in the rest of the talk. Now, one last premise before going to the actual topic. The theory we have is clearly invariant under CP. Parity, instead, is not a symmetry unless the theory is vector-like. And vector-like, I mean, unless left and right-handed fermions transform in the same way. However, it is useful to introduce a generalized version of parity. This acts on the field as standard parity, essentially, and on the generators in such a way that the resulting action is invariant under parity. Now, this kind of special parity reduces to parity in the case of a normal P invariant theory. With this in mind, now P and CP are symmetries of the action. And
no, I don't think I understand. What parity do we have? The special parity, what is that?
Well, it just, you treat parity is violated, but you can treat it as a spurious symmetry. So that's simply the idea. Mm-hmm. So in the case, if you have a theory that preserves parity, real parity, it will also preserve automatically also the spurious parity.
Okay.
So the reason to do this is that it will give us selection rules to describe the counter term we will want to build.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we introduced. So CP is actually a good symmetry. Still, even for that, we treat it as a spurious transformation, again, to be able to use these selection rules. And we will be able to do it because we will choose a regularization that preserves this symmetry.
Okay. Both of them?
Both of them, yeah. Well, yes, preserves this spurious version of parity, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now I can state which is my goal. My goal is to remove the unphysical gauge violating contribution that I created by regularizing my theory. And I want to do that by adding some counter terms to the classical action. Now, we can always remove these breakings with local counter terms. For the moment, believe me, I will prove why this is the case in a few slides. Okay, but what we want to do is to characterize these counter terms at one loop for a wide class of regularization schemes. And we want to do that with functional methods. And then, since the most used regularization nowadays is dimensional regularization, we want to do this specifically, explicitly for this specific case.
a question. So you're also going to kick the gauge, right? To compute the effective action, you need to kick the gauge.
Yes, I'll tell you how.
Yes, and that will, and the effective action then is not gauge invariant. So
it will be because I will use the background fill method.
It will be invariant on the background.
Yes, and that will be enough for my purposes.
Okay, let's see.
Okay, so what do we have to do? We start from the classical action, and the first step is to regularize it. Then we have to quantize our theory, and we have to renormalize it. So renormalizing in the usual sense of renormalization, removing the infinities. And finally, we can do what I want to talk about, which is restore gauge invariance. So essentially add a counter term to the effective action. So the counter term is, well, okay, I don't want to use the pointer. so that the sum of the original effective action plus the counter term is gauge invariant. So, okay, let's start by stating our assumptions about the regularizations. We want a regularization that satisfies these four properties. So we want it to be invariant under vectorial gauge transformations. And this means in particular that if we start from a vector-like theory, we still want to end up with a vector-like theory even after regularizing it. We want the regularization to respect invariance under four-dimensional Lorentz transformations. We want to respect invariance under generalized parity and under CP. And we want it to respect the quantum action principle. Okay, the next step is to quantize. And this part needs a little bit more attention because we know that when we quantize a non-abelian theory, we have to introduce some gauge fixing and a Fadev-Popov term, and these in general break gauge invariance. So gauge invariance is replaced by the BRST symmetry. And in particular, word identities are replaced by nonlinear identities, the Slavnov-Taylor identities. This nonlinearity makes identifying our counterterms really hard. So this has been done in the past. People who have tried to do that have done this by using these identities, and it's much more complicated than if you use the background field method. And I don't know if you're all familiar with it, and before working on it, I wasn't. So I will just try to sketch what's the idea of the background field method. So first of all, within the background field method, all fields are split in a classical background plus a quantum fluctuation. Color code should be clear. And then the effective action is obtained by integrating over the quantum fluctuations. So it's essentially a function just of the classical background fields. And the action appearing in the exponential contains the action we started from, gauge fixing, and the Gauss term. But we make a smart choice of gauge fixing. And with this smart choice, the action is invariant under transformations of the back gauge transformations of the background fields. And this implies that the effective action I defined there, which is completely equivalent to the standard effective action, satisfies the linear word identity up to the regularization effects. So my goal will be that this satisfies the word identities, but formally this is what happens. So we want to use this background field method. Okay, this is really the main advantage of using this method. So, I think I said it already. In the end, we know that even if we choose the other way, okay, gauge invariance is lost at intermediate steps, but we have to find it in the end. But this way I can have Green functions, everything is gauge invariant, even at intermediate steps.
Yeah, but I very much sympathize with this approach, but that's not enough. That's only, well, that works well at one loop. If you want to do a realization with higher loops, that becomes much more complicated. You have to keep this quantum field as well.
Indeed, yes, absolutely. So we right now I'm doing one loop. We are thinking of extending the formalist to two loops, and there it's more complicated. Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, I agree.
Okay.
Sorry, is it obvious why this gamma that you get is k covariant? Is there some simple way of seeing like, oh yeah, this was the natural choice to make, or is this just something that is pulled up?
Well, if you do the, you know how the standard gauge fields transform under a gauge transformation, you can write down these transformations also for the background fields. You plug them in and it's gauge invariant. As long as you choose this gauge fixing though, the choice of the gauge fixing is important.
But that's what I'm asking, is it, sorry, like maybe I just can't do this in my head, but is it like, it seems like there's a very natural structure to this, like the FAs that you're defining seem like they're tied intimately to like the covariant derivative structure or something like this. So I'm asking, is there some easy way that I see like, oh yeah, this is exactly what I need to do?
Yes, so the background gauge fields transform essentially linearly under the symmetry. So that term is.
I think the question is whether that this product is invariant under the spontaneous transformation of gauge fields and
background fields.
Yeah, that kind of that's how the structure is chosen. Yeah. At three level.
Okay.
And then because this the ground gauge information are linear, they're not anomaly. They're preserved by whatever. If we don't break them by regularization, they're preserved.
I see. Thank you.
Okay. So now concerning renormalization here, I don't have a specific regularization scheme in mind for the moment. So I kind of assume that there is a constant, a consistent subtraction procedure, which allows me to evaluate the renormalized effective action from the regularized one. And this procedure is such that the effective action is finite order by order. So this is just a statement about, let's assume we can do this. Four-dimensional regularization, I will spend a few more words. Having done this, let's talk about restoring gauge invariance. So I want to convince you that my plan makes sense, namely that we can always add finite counterterms to the effective action such that the result is gauge invariant. And we can prove this by induction. So say we have an effective action that satisfies the word identities up to loop order n minus one. And now at the next order, in general, we will know that this gauge invariance will be broken, but the quantum action principle implies that this variation has a particular form. In particular, okay, this object here is the generating functional of all one particle irreducible Green functions with an insertion of this delta. And this delta sounds fancy, but it's actually easy. This delta is just a local polynomial in the fields. So we are saying that this variation is described by graphs, which are the standard graph you will build in your theory, with insertion of a local polynomial. This local polynomial has to respect some symmetries given the regularization we chose. It has to be CP odd, P even, invariant under 4D Lorentz, and also to vanish if the theory is vector-like. So we don't want any gauge violation for a vector-like theory. Now, this delta also has to satisfy the vast domino condition I was mentioning before, because it's just a functional. And if we take a non-anomalous theory, so one that satisfies the Georgi condition, then the solution, the most general solution to this equation, has this form. So essentially, it's the gauge variation of an integrated polynomial in the fields and in their derivatives, which again has the same properties I was mentioning before. So it's invariant under 4D Lorentz, under P, in this case also under CP, and it vanishes for a vector-like theory. Now, if we add, here I put this equation in a special orange box because I will need it later. So remember the orange box. Okay, now if we add this counter term to the effective action we had at the beginning, by construction, we get something that is gauge invariant. Oops.
So this is a very non-trivial statement.
Yes.
So you have proof for that? Or?
There is a proof that this is the trivial cohomology essentially of this object. So I don't prove it here. It has been proven, yes. So here essentially what I'm doing here is only the proof that you can do this thing by induction at any order, but the statement that this is the solution for non-anomalous theory is a non-trivial statement, which I'm not proving here.
Yeah, I'm not sure that it's proved for, well, for Young Mills, right?
For Young Mills, yes. For Young Mills, Young Mills with fermions and scalars, yes. I don't know about more general theories.
This is the Barnish and Noh, right? This work by now, right?
Yes. Okay, so this was the, let's say, the introductory part. I can stop if you want to protest or I don't. Okay, if not, I move on. So, okay, the explicit form of the gauge variation of effective action, this delta here, and of the counter term depends on the regularization, but we can understand several of the properties just by the properties I mentioned before, the orange property. So now I want to do this one loop analysis for these well-behaved regularization schemes. And let me start by giving you a convenient representation for the gauge variation of the effective action, this delta. Delta, I said, is a finite polynomial of dimension 4 in the gauge and in the fermionic fields. So we can expand it in a basis of monomials. And okay, that's obvious that was the monomial, and you see them in the first column of the table. Here, okay, I add this index A to the monomial. It's just a proxy for all indices. It could be gauge indices, spinor indices, chirality indices. And then we have these coefficients here that inherit some symmetry properties from the properties of the monomials. Now we said that this delta has to satisfy the Vastu-Minow condition. And this gives many, many relations between these coefficients, these tensors. So I will just write all these conditions in this simple way. So Vastu-Minow of C is equal to zero. Just to give you an example, this is how these conditions look for a few of these operators. Just imagine many, many tensor equations. Okay, but then we can do a similar decomposition for the counter term. So here, the counter term is integrated over spacetime. So whenever we have monomials that are related by integration by parts, they don't really give independent results in the counterterm action. So we can expand these objects in a basis which is smaller with respect to the one we used before. And again, from the symmetry properties of the monomials, we can derive those of the coefficients in front. Now we can take the gauge variation of this object. And okay, the result again can be decomposed in the basis we introduced before, with the important difference that these objects here, by construction, already satisfy the best domino conditions. Okay, so now we can go back to the condition to restore where the identity is at one loop. That was the orange one. And we can write it like the pink box. So we can write it in terms of these coefficients. Okay, we wrote these conditions assuming the theory to be anomaly free. If the field content of the theory for some reason is anomalous, then in principle there is some anomaly in here. But okay, if the field content of the theory is anomalous, we can anyway split the gauge variation of the effective action into two contributions, only one of which can be removed by counter terms. So this is our, the pink one is our master equation, the fundamental equation we want to solve. It's essentially a set of linear equations that determine this coefficient here, the coefficients of the counter term, as a function of the coefficients that describe the variation of the effective action. Now remember that these also need to satisfy the vast domino condition, so we have to solve both of these equations, and that's the plan. How do we do that? We find which is the most general form of the coefficient satisfying the vast domino conditions, and then we find the counter terms such that our master equation works. So these are many equations with many tensors. So we needed a good idea to do something with them apart from staring at them. And so the first thing to notice is that at one loop, sorry, these tensors are just at one, this holds at one loop. These tensors are linear combinations of single traces of generators. So this C and the chi's, you see, are just some coefficients. And then we have traces of a certain number of generators. And there are several constraints that restrict the form of this parametrization a lot. The properties under parity, under CP. We know how these objects behave under exchange of indices. And we also know that the C and the C hats, they have to be zero for vector-like theories, because again, in vector-like theories, we don't have this Fourier breaking of gauge invariants. Let me show you how this works for one easy coefficient, because we don't want to do this for all of them. Like, we have to, but not now. And the example is this C1. Okay, here you see it has three indices in the adjoint of the gauge group. So I will need traces of three different generators with three gauge indices. Then it has to be CP even and P odd. And there are only two combinations that satisfy these requirements. And then it has to be symmetric in the exchange of P and C. So I have to symmetrize these combinations. And the result is that from the symmetry considerations, we can say that this object can depend only on two parameters. Okay. Okay, another important point is that this master equation I was showing you before consists of three sets of equations that don't talk to each other. Those that involve fermions or fermions and gauge fields, and those that involve only gauge fields. And among those, we have some which contain only P even operators and only P odd operators. So these are really three completely independent sets of equations. Here, I don't want to solve all of them explicitly, but to show you the logic, how this works, especially for the bosonic sector. So let me stick to P even operators in the bosonic sector. So in the first column, you see the variation, the gauge variation of the effective action. And in the second one, you see the counterterms. So the gauge variation of the effective action before I apply the vast domino condition depends on 61 parameters. Then it turns out that the vast domino conditions give me 49 conditions. It's a bit of numerology, but the numbers at the end matter. So just be patient for a second. Okay, so we have 12 really independent parameters. And instead, for the counterterms, okay, no vast domino conditions here, we have 13 parameters available. So you see that here we always have the freedom, even in an anomalous theory, to choose the counterterms in such a way that we remove the spurious anomaly induced by the regularization. And actually, we remain with one more parameter. And what this guy does, this 13 minus 12 equals 1, is just to give us the possibility of adding a gauge invariant term to our counterterm. So, okay, it's meant to be there to cancel gauge violating contributions, but a gauge invariant contribution doesn't hurt. So we have the freedom to have this term.
Actually, why only one?
It turns out it's one. What do you mean?
Yeah, no, I have
but wait, here I'm considering only the bosonic P even sector. Yes, in the fermionic sector it works in an analogous way. Again, I can choose the counterterms to remove the spurious anomalies induced by the regularization. I have a residual freedom, and there is a gauge invariant counterterm I can add there. So yes, absolutely.
Okay, so it's
one. So it's two in total.
Yes.
And the other one has has both chiralities. So it's actually three.
Mm-hmm.
We count that way. For the P odd sector, okay, here I messed up. Here the story is a little bit different. I won't repeat the whole description, but we have four available parameters three available counterterms and four parameters we would like to cancel. And we can't do that. So here, we don't have the freedom to cancel the variation, the gauge variation of the effective action completely. We remain with one term. And you see that this term is exactly the one that multiplies the Georgi anomaly. This means, we just recover something we already knew from the literature, which is that this object cannot be removed by a counterterm. The only way to remove it is to have that tensor, that DABC, to be zero. Okay. So to wrap up, here we found sort of a general map between the gauge variation of the effective action and the counterterm we need. But now I want to pick a specific regularization, and I pick the one we use every day, which is dimensional regularization. The idea of dimensional regularization is very simple. Let's say simple. And is to extend Lorentz indices from four dimensions to D complex dimensions, four minus two epsilon, four minus epsilon, depending on your convention. Four minus two is always better, I think. What's causing the breaking of gauge invariance in the context of dimensional regularization is the so-called gamma five problem. So gamma 5 in four dimensions has three properties. It anti-commutes with all gamma matrices. The trace of four gamma matrices and gamma 5 is 4i, the Levi Civita. And then we clearly have the cyclicity of the trace. And there is no way of defining gamma 5 in D dimensions such that all these properties are satisfied. Now, there have been many, many proposals to deal with this, but I don't want to go into the details, but you might have heard about reading point prescriptions or things like that. But only one prescription, which is the Toft-Weltmann, well, Toft-Weltmann started it, and Breitel-Loren and Maison proved that it's consistent to all orders. So here I write all the letters. Sometimes I will say just Toft-Weltmann. So only this prescription has proven to be consistent to all orders. So what's the idea? Okay, in general, in Dimbrack, we can always split d-dimensional indices as a four-dimensional piece, which is the one with the hat, and a d minus four-dimensional piece. Sorry, the four is one with the bar, and the hat is the d minus four. In Toft-Weltmann, gamma five is defined as an intrinsically four-dimensional object. The other gamma matrices split into contributions. Gamma five commutes with the four-dimensional one, sorry, anti-commutes with the four-dimensional one, and commutes with the epsilon-dimensional one. And this is the prescription I'm going to use. Now, okay, we wrote our effective our action, and now we want our regularized action. How do we do that? For the bosonic sector, it's very easy. We can continue it to d dimensions. We just keep writing f mu nu with the index mu that lives in d dimensions. And we can do that without violating any symmetry of the action we started from. So this thing preserves gauge invariance. The fermionic part is a bit more complicated. So for the fermionic term, we have to continue to the dimension because we need to regularize propagators in loops. So, okay, this guy here, this mu needs to live in the dimension. Instead, we have more freedom in the interaction term because here, the only requirement in practice is that this thing reduces to the four-dimensional interaction for d equals four. But apart from this, we can do everything. So all these possibilities you see here, sandwiching the gamma between the two projectors, or just choosing gamma mu p left or p right gamma mu, they are all good possibilities. But they introduce clearly a skin dependence.
R is what is 4D.
Yes, I didn't have to put the 4D there because as soon as I sandwich a d-dimensional gamma between right and left, the only piece that survives is the four-dimensional piece. I just wanted to kind of underline that with that choice, which is the one I will make, that part of the interaction is essentially equal to the four-dimensional one. So we only continue the kinetic term. Okay, this d-dimensional kinetic term, which has to be there, we said, mediates transitions between different chiralities. And you see that if you open up that first term, and you see there are some epsilon evanescent terms, the hatted terms, that make left talk to right. And this breaks gauge invariance. So below you see the expression for the breaking of gauge invariance. Now, first thing, we see that this goes away. The theory is vector-like, as it should be. And the second point is that this object is evanescent. So if we just cared about three-level stuff, we could just throw it away without problems. But now we want to go to yes.
Never mind, I understand. Okay, yeah.
No, go ahead. Okay.
I'm sorry.
No, it's all right. I got lost. Okay, so this is just the way we define the regularized action. I showed you this expression before. In this case, the precise regularization is dimensional regularization. Again, here in the exponential, we are including also the gauge fixing and the ghost part. And we are interested in the gauge variation of this object. Now, an important property of Dimbrack is that in DIMREC, the path integral measure is invariant. So for any local transformation of the gauge field, the Jacobian is going to be one. So the breaking of gauge invariance comes only from the non-invariance of the classical action. This might be different with respect to what you've seen when studying, for example, the U1 chiral anomaly, and usually you don't do that in dimension regularization. And what happens is that the measure of the path integral is not invariant under the transformation. In DIMREC, that doesn't play a role. So everything goes into the non-invariance of the classical action, where these evanescent terms can multiply divergent integrals and give rise to finite contributions that violate gauge invariance. Okay, well, I said that in order to find this counter term, we want the gauge.
Is this obvious? Like, is it obvious that the one in DIMREC?
It's about the scalelessness. Okay, whenever you do a local transformation of the gauge fields, you end up with a d-dimensional delta in zero. Uh-huh. That object is scaleless. So, yes. Well, it wasn't obvious to me, but once I saw it.
Even with a fermion mass, you never do
get massless fermions.
Fermions are massless here.
So is this statement still true if you have a fermion mass?
I think so. Yes, I think it is.
Okay.
Because I wouldn't expect the mass to show up as a scale in this delta. So this is the Jacobian associated to the gauge transformations of the fermions.
Uh-huh.
And the mass doesn't really enter in there. So I wouldn't expect it to play a role. I could be wrong.
I guess.
But I can believe it. Yeah, certainly if it's massless, then I see this as helpful.
Okay, but this is the gauge variation of the regularized effective action. And we would like the renormalized one. So I have to tell you, how do I go from gamma D to gamma?
So just understand, so your fermions, they're full fermions. Yes, basically having left and right part, right?
Yes.
So that's what enters into the measure, right? You integrate over the full fermions and the projector, they appear in the edge. That's the trick.
Yes.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah, I think that's the reason.
Okay, now the regularized action at one loop has two types of contributions, non-evanescent ones and evanescent ones, and both of them can be both of them can be, I'm almost done, I swear, can be finite or divergent. And we choose a minimal subtraction scheme, which means that we define our renormalized action by subtracting all divergent terms, both evanescent and non-evanescent. So essentially, we kill these two guys. And then we take the limit d equal 4. Taking the limit d equal 4 here, sorry, let me go back. In this expression simply means forgetting about the evanescent terms and then sending all momenta in the non-evanescent term to four dimensions, essentially. Okay, so now we take the gauge variation. And this is the object we want. This is the object we want to compute. We can compute it directly from the gauge variation of the unrenormalized, regularized action. What we have to do is to simply keep the finite piece and drop everything else. Now, this is a big simplification that we can do at one loop. At two loop, it's more complicated. There, I would also need an explicit expression of the one loop counter terms I need to remove the evanescent piece. So this is a particularly easy case. So it's a bit of a subtle point. We don't care about it that much for one loop, but if we ever gonna want to go beyond, this I guess might be one of the biggest difficulties. Okay, then we computed this thing. I won't show you the computation. We did it with the path integral, with the heat kernel method, and we did many cross checks with Feynman diagrams. Well, essentially, we cross checked everything also diagrammatically. And this gauge variation at one loop has two contributions, two main contributions. One then depends only on the gauge fields in the blue box. Here you see these A's and B's. We found convenient to express this variation in terms of axial vector and vector objects, because this way it is easier to see what happens in the limit in which the theory is vector-like. So if you just kill the axial vectors. And in the red box, you see the contribution that is due to the fermions. Just a few comments on this result. Okay, I already said how we computed it, that we checked the diagrams. Another check we made is that we put it in the same form I mentioned before, so this parameterization. And here you see some of the values of this cyst, and the expressions get bigger and bigger with increasing indices. And we checked that they all satisfy the vast domino conditions, so we're sure that our result is correct. Finally, we can compute the counterterm knowing all these things. This is the counterterm. It looks a bit disappointing. It was the goal of the whole thing. It stays on one slide. It's not gauge invariant by definition because it's there to remove gauge violating things. It's zero for a vector-like theory. So you see, if you send A to zero, it's zero. And it's consistent with the map between the anomaly and the counterterm I derived for a general regularization.
How do I see that it vanishes for vector-like? Where should I look?
You can send to zero A.
What is A? H field. Why should I send it?
No, that's the curly A. Sorry. The curly A is a gauge. Yes. Okay.
Yes, barely.
There was more pointing than the pointer. No, it was down there. Okay, that's my counterterm. Just to finish, we decided to do this for the standard model.
Before you move on.
Yeah. Sorry.
Is there any intuition about the different terms?
Yes. So the first line, essentially, these are the parity violating objects. One thing you will see is that how do you see that? Because there is an odd number of axial vectors. It's always one, it's one or three. The second line instead has always an even number of axial vectors. So, well, maybe it would be, can I use the blackboard?
Yeah.
It's easier if you think about the diagrams where they come from. So the terms with the that depends only on the gauge fields, they come from wave function renormalization. They come from the usual triangle graph. They come from these boxes. And instead, those with the fermions essentially come from these two. Wait, the one on the top. Okay. Oh, and by the way, it's important that these objects are computed in the background gauge. The Feynman rules are different for the background. But okay, these are the type of graphs you see. And then For example, take for example this object. When you take the gauge variation of this, you will get a piece which depends on r square, and one piece which remains a cube. Same way, this guy will contribute to the a cube and a to the fourth stuff. And this gives the linear term, which has to vanish, and a square. So yeah, I'm not sure I can give you a better intuition than this.
But the last term looks weird.
The last term looks weird. Why? This is this object here.
What is GAA?
Sorry, yes, we are. I should have written it also in this expression. I have it in the previous slide. So we are leaving the possibility of having an
chasm here or something.
Yes, because our gauge group could be a product of more groups.
Okay.
So if you just have one gauge group, it's just its gauge coupling square.
Okay.
And yeah, I wrote it, but I didn't say it. Here one has to rescale the fields to normalize the kinetic terms. Okay, so just to finish.
So after rescaling, every term here is proportional to g squared. Is that what I'm supposed to?
To g cube, actually.
G cube. Okay. Yeah, okay.
The t's also carry a g. So just think of this graph, it's g cube. Okay, standard model. This is a partial result because we haven't included scalars. So this would be the counterterm for the standard model if we don't have Yukawa couplings. I have the full counterterm in the backup. First, I just wanted to show you the type of vertices it contains. So you see there are vertices with several vector bosons. There are vertices between vector bosons and the W. I wrote everything in terms of the fields in the broken phase, because this way you can see that the dependence on the photon field, so on the vector part of the gauge group, is only through covariant derivatives and through the affine union. So these terms is manifestly invariant under U1. Well, yes, I write it here. It has to be invariant under the vector groups. For SU3, it's actually funny because in principle, you could have gluons in there as long as they appear in covariant derivatives or in field strengths. But at dimension 4, the only colorless objects you can build with those building blocks are gauge invariant. So they never enter this term, while photons can be there. Another point which I didn't expect, it just happens for the standard model, is that there are no counterterms with the Levi Civita. And the reason is the SU2 algebra. So if instead of SU2 we had SU3, it wouldn't be the case. I don't know if there is anything deeper to that for the moment, but I found that interesting. Okay, I'm really done. Just to wrap up. So any regularization scheme gives an apparent violation of gauge invariance if we have a chiral gauge theory. So these theories need a renormalization procedure in two steps. The first step is the usual one. So you remove the infinities with divergent counterterms. And the second step is to remove finite gauge violating contributions by adding the counterterms I told you about. And so our main result was an analytical expression of these finite one-loop counterterms, first for a certain class of regularization schemes, and then we did it explicitly for dimensional regularization. Something I didn't mention before, the main difference with respect to other approaches on the subject were to use the background field method first, to include charged fermions of both chiralities, and then we don't need additional sterile fermions. Maybe this is a bit more technical. I can give you the references for that. another way of dealing with this problem is essentially to introduce fake sterile fermions such that the chirality flipping between right and left doesn't happen between two physical fermions. But let's say this one is the real guy and this is a fake fermion. Okay. And last, what we want to do next is to see if we can extend this to theories with scalars and then to this map. We hope that this output could be implemented in automated one-loop computations in this map. So we are working with groups that do this type of calculations to understand in which format they would need our results and so on. So don't expect a big numerical impact of these things. They are finite pieces you add to an NLO calculations, but your results will be gauge invariant. So yeah, that's it.
Great talk. Any questions?
Yeah, I ask more.
Yeah, go.
So, so you removed this Arnaton term as well, right? Because it has a ball on the graph.
Yes, yes.
You would not remove it.
Sorry?
What would happen if you wouldn't remove it? Because you kept. Yeah, it's fine, right?
Yeah. It's fine. So it's what we did is all part of the. Of the scheme.
Right. No, but I just want to not remove it. Do you get the gauge invariant automatically or not? Or you still have to have counter terms?
If I don't remove it, I still have four dimensional gauge invariants. I think it would just modify my counter terms by a finite amount. Yeah.
Okay, so basically it does well.
Yes, but let's say that way, if you remove also that, the piece you're subtracting the full divergent gauge d-dimensional gauge invariant piece. Otherwise, you're just subtracting the four-dimensional gauge invariant divergent piece. You see what I mean?
If I don't subtract the one.
Exactly. So it's okay because what you care about is the d equal four gauge invariants. But there, ideally. Yeah, we decided to subtract as much as we could while respecting d-dimensional gauge invariants.
Right. Yeah, then I think I'm confused. So if you're you start from d-dimensional gauge invariant.
Yes.
You subtract the gauge invariant divergence from it. So
yes.
Is the d-dimensional gauge invariant, right?
Sorry, say again, the remaining?
So the final part remains is a gauge invariant from d-dimensions, isn't it? Your effective action. Is it gauge invariant in d-dimensions?
The part that remains?
Yeah,
no.
You say you subtract?
No, only the part that remains is not gauge invariant in d-dimensions.
Ah, well, actually, the whole of the gauge invariant in d-dimensions, you're saying.
So the whole.
Yeah,
so, no. Yeah, the whole action is not gauge invariant in 4, so it's not even invariant under d.
Okay, indeed.
But the divergences,
okay.
If I did everything right, should be gauge invariant in the dimensions.
Okay, I see.
Michael, you say anything? I do have a question. You say no need for additional sterile neutrinos, fermions.
Yes.
So for the neutrinos.
Those wouldn't be, they wouldn't really be neutrinos. They would be, you would need a sterile fermion or
what is
all fermions.
Yeah,
that's.
It's something which is not charged under the gauge group. It just appears in intermediate state, never appears as an external state.
But it's not physical for you, or?
Yeah, it's non physical. It's absolutely non physical.
What is that? Set amount of trees for masses. No, they have mass. So the solution is either you have a right handed between them, which is not effective, or you have non renormalizable interactions. There's only two possibilities. You can't have a Higgs interaction in the standard model of neutrinos unless you have non renormalizable.
Sure, absolutely, but here the point was just these terminals I'm talking about are auxiliary fields one can introduce to parameterize this type of interactions, but at the end, clearly they must drop from the results. So I'm not talking about real particles.
What you say is correct.
Okay.
Just raising the issue.
Sure.
So can you please tell us a bit on the concrete applications that you said, like probably an NLO or something?
Well, yeah, this if you do an NLO calculation of Dreyjan, blah blah blah, using Toff Weltmann, which is usually what people don't do. Usually you do naive dimensional regularization.
Right.
Now at one loop that might lead you to a wrong result. Actually, at one loop, there are techniques that allow you to anyway recover the right result. For example, if you do naive dimreg and introduce a reading point, which means you introduce a rule that all the fermion traces you have, you read them always starting from a certain point. So that way you can avoid the inconsistencies that naive dimreg has intrinsically. And at one loop, you would obtain the right result. The problem is that these tricks haven't been extended to, like, you don't really know what's going to happen at the next order.
The next order in what?
Perturbation theory.
But anyways, you're just stopping at the, you're saying like one higher order perturbation theory or something, then is there a specific example where you see that there will be a mistake in a
WW scattering, okay, for example,
and that you check that is your answer is different from the answer that it's on the literature or something?
No, but it's not different, because in the literature what happens is that people account for the inconsistency introduced by using naive dimensional regularization and correct for that.
So what about that? I guess another way to ask a similar question to Tanya. So here, the advantage that you give is a consistent way to do the one loop regular renormalization.
Yes, it's the idea.
Really knowing what I'm trying to guess what the answer is.
Yes. I'm not sure it's the best way to go in general, because the top Weltmann is that it is pretty complicated to use, at least for a person. For a machine, there, well, it's true. So this is something we are also, I'm also wondering, and I'm not sure this would be the best way to go ever.
But then going back to the conclusion, so is there an example that you know that people have,
for example,
in the counter term, they got it wrong or something?
I know an example of an NLO calculation of WW scattering in the SMEFT, where the result is not gauge invariant, and people find the counter term by hand.
Yeah.
If you do it our way, you just have it gauge invariant.
In the SMEFT?
Yes.
I'm not sure this is relevant, but that is gauge theory, which is a form of regularization.
Yes.
You have what's called the minimum media theorem. You're doubling.
That's my question.
No, it's really. Well, doesn't, so the analysis we did here does not apply, to that. So, no. Yeah.
You only deal with a continuum.
Yeah, it's for analytical, like, yes. So I don't think it would work.
Sorry. Can I ask a different question?
Yes.
You mentioned that there, you know, you did some counting, you said, okay, there's also some extra terms, some extra data you're bearing power.
Yeah.
What are these? Like, well, in other words, I might have expected that each counter term, like I should basically have the structure of my counter terms fixed by the operators that are already in the theory. So are these just counter terms that would be there for operators that you didn't include, or?
No, so those counter terms essentially just add a finite contribution to counter to terms you already have at tree level, for example, to the kinetic term.
I see.
So then, if you want to canonically renormalize your kinetic term, either you do another field redefinition and do that.
They are all operators, like they all are
yes.
Operators that are already in the
graph. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So the whole thing started because some collaborators we have that work on this one loop automated calculation on top Veltman, they asked us whether a list of these counter terms existed. And we thought, yes, sure. And we checked and there wasn't. So I guess with our work, we did what they asked us for. But maybe I shouldn't say it because it's my seminar. But I'm myself not sure of whether this is the way to go in general for all orders. So I see the power of the Toth-Veltman prescription in being consistent for all orders, but I also see the complications that come with it. Probably ideally, the best thing would be to be able to find another prescription which retains the anti-commutativity of gamma 5 in D dimensions. And that we have a way to correct for the mistake we are doing arbitrarily at all orders. That would be the best, I think. So far, it doesn't exist. Maybe.
The final result shouldn't depend on the choice of this regularization, right? Your point is how to implement it at higher
rules
or with scalars?
No, okay. First, here, two things. We want to stick to one loop for the moment.
Yeah, okay.
Also, because in this math right now, it doesn't really make a lot of sense to do three SMAF computations. So before we go to this math, we have to understand scalars.
Yeah.
They will just add terms. So I don't, we will have more to compute, but I don't expect them to do much more. And then once that is done, we want to try with this math, but always at one loop.
Yeah. And so I don't see where the limitations you were mentioning comes in. Like
when, if we go to higher orders.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So,
so for now, still.
For now, yes. Just in perspective, I think once the one loop thing is over, I'm not sure there is a practical advantage in trying to push this to higher orders. I know there are people working on this, for example, I don't know if you know him. His name is Stockinger Beluska. They have been working on these things and they want to go to higher orders. But I'm not convinced yet whether That makes sense.
And the third group, you need to use analog ordered entities.
The alternative would be, yes, to kind of fix the problem by hand all the time. But the problem is that you could end up making mistakes, even engaging variant pieces. That's the thing. That's the main problem. Yeah.
But shouldn't there be any kind of statement? Anomaly comes from one loop, you know, right?
The anomalies with this anomaly here come from one loop.
But
you don't have just anomalies with fermion loops. Here we are talking also about this type of anomalies. So they are not the real anomaly. The physical anomaly is the one that comes from fermion loops.
Yes.
But we are also dealing with these situations. And here you can have as many loops as you don't need a fermion loop to have a spurious anomaly.
Yeah, I think you want some kind of regularization that would only give real anomalies, right? Real anomalies, right?
I agree.
Okay, I suggest we thank Claudia again, stop recording, and then.